Welcome to the Cutter's Notch podcast, hosted by author Michael DeCamp and his family. Recorded in the Cutter's Notch studios, this podcast explores anything related to creativity. You'll find interviews with creative people, such as authors, artists, and performers, as well as friendly banter about any number of topics. Turn up the volume, listen, and catch up on what's happening in Cutter's Notch.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Cutter's Notch podcast. Welcome back. I'm your host, Michael DeCamp, and with me, as usual, is the star of the show.
The reluctant co-host, Angela DeCamp.
She says she's reluctant,
Help,
but she
I'm
really
trapped.
Loves being here. She really loves doing this, and as do I. We have a lot of fun with it, and we're just glad to be back for the second episode of our second season.
This is our first episode where we have an author, too, so it's exciting.
In the second season. We had several authors in the first
season. Yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying is with the second season.
Gotcha.
Anyway.
So anyway, we're glad to be back. We're glad everyone's here, and hopefully you're listening. And we're going to start off, I guess, a little bit with our normal kind of what are we reading or what's our creative moment of the episode. Creative moment of the episode. So, Angela, what do you got for us?
I want to let you know, I know that you have a reason for doing this, but you always make me go first, and I share a 30-second bite, and then you share like four books you're reading and tell the entire plot. Just keep that in mind.
Now, that's not true.
That's an exaggeration.
You're the one that's read like 26 books this year already.
Yeah, okay. This is true. But all right, I have to be a little critical. I just wanted you to know that.
I've noticed that,
and I think our listeners have noticed that.
No taken.
I sense it's unfair. So the book I'll bring up that I've read this year is actually one of the newer bestsellers called The Midnight Library by Matt Haig, H-A-I-G. I might have misspelled that or mispronounced that, but it is, you can find it pretty much anywhere. It's a fictional story. It's very similar to like, and It's a Wonderful Life. So I kind of feel like you might actually like it, but it's this, kind of about this woman who, is in a situation where she might have the opportunity to look at what her life would look like in different, if she'd made different choices, and she is able to hop into different lives and kind of, see, would it have been better if I'd have made this decision? Like, should I have been an Olympic swimmer? Should I have gone to geology and kind of play out what that was like? And is that life really, is a different life worth it? Or is the one that you're currently living worthwhile? And it was really interesting read. It's a very quick read too. It's a very short book. So if you're going on a vacation, a safe, socially distant vacation, or just staying at home and not working, it's a good quick one to get through. And I really enjoyed it.
Cool. Well, I am going to share about two books.
I knew it. See, I knew you'd do more than one.
Not five, but I'm going to share about two. But you'll understand why two here in just a moment. But the first one I want to share about is The Bird Box, or I guess it's just Bird Box by Josh Malerman, which you might recognize because it was turned into a Netflix movie.
Mm-hmm.
And really a great little book.
I've actually heard that the book is better than the movie, which I guess is pretty common.
Yeah, they usually are.
Yeah.
But I would say in this case that they did the movie pretty well.
Good.
But the book obviously is much more detailed, but they were very true to the book.
Okay.
In the movie.
So if you liked the movie, then maybe you would like the book.
If you're not familiar with Bird Box, the concept is it's kind of an apocalyptic kind of story. The world has kind of come to an end because there's some sort of something that is causing people to go insane as soon as they see them, and they either kill themselves or kill someone else and then kill themselves.
Sounds like a heartwarming tale.
Yeah. So the only way to survive is to not look at anything. So you have to go around blindfolded or keep yourself closed up into a building or home. And it basically follows one young woman who actually is pregnant. She discovers she's pregnant right as this is beginning to happen. So very suspenseful and very creative, very interesting take on an apocalyptic kind of end of the world kind of thing.
Probably somebody who really loved and cared about you probably got you that book.
It probably was. Probably my other daughter.
Hey.
Just kidding.
Firstborn over here.
Firstborn. So the other book that I have read
Recently.
I just finished yesterday.
Oh, okay.
It's a nonfiction book, and it's a memoir. written by someone I know.
Really?
Yeah. And her name is Marilyn Crete, and the name of the book is Paradise Road, a memoir.
Oh.
And you know what's amazing, Angela?
What is amazing, Michael?
We actually have Marilyn with us right now on this podcast.
What?
Yeah. Hello, Marilyn.
Hello, both of you. Great to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for taking time.
Thank you for reading my book.
For just a second, I thought you were going to pull a prank on us and not answer.
Just silent. No,
remember how I feel about practical jokes. I'm not that person.
That's right. That's right. Well, to see if you were my wife, you would have done it because she loves practical jokes. But.
But
we're so happy to have you with us, and we're looking forward to talking about your book. And for the listeners, I started to say leaders. It's a combination of readers and listeners are leaders. So anyway, for those of you listening out there, Marilyn, just for complete transparency, Marilyn and I have known each other for about 20 years, and but we haven't seen each other in probably, I didn't do the calculations, Marilyn, because I don't remember when you actually left Indianapolis, but it's probably been.
Yeah, I think it was 2000.
When you left?
I haven't seen you since,
Wow, 21 years.
Yeah.
I haven't seen you longer than I've known you.
Jed, I don't know that math is your strong suit. It doesn't sound like.
Well, you know what? I went to Muncie Southside. And, so no offense on my math teachers
math
over there,
but
I was not the best at math.
More of a memory thing than it is probably, after a while, times and dates get hazy and all that. So I get that.
But Marilyn and I have known each other for over 20
a really
years.
Long time.
A really long time. Yeah. And considering that we're both only like 35, it's amazing that we've known each other for 21
so
years.
So weird that I'm only 4 years younger than you guys.
So actually, Marilyn, why don't you tell folks a little bit about who you are now
and
what you were doing in Indianapolis then, and then that'll give some perspective of the memoir that we're going to talk about next. Can you do that for us a little
bit? Okay. Well, I'll start with when I met you, which was in Indianapolis many years ago. And my husband Henry and I were there. We came there for about 3 years and helped lead the church there. And my first memory of really talking to you, Mike, is actually on a bike ride, which is, I think, very significant. We rode together on part of one of your 70-mile mission challenge rides.
Yes.
And I remember telling you quite a bit about this bike journey that's in my book at the time, which was kind of unusual because I didn't really talk about it with a lot of people. But it just seemed like a apropos thing to talk about as we rode our bike side by side through the Indiana countryside. And, since that time, well, my husband and I we were in the ministry for a long time and served overseas in India and Africa and lots of different churches in the States. And then we came back to Canada, which is where we're from originally, in 2003 and, kind of started reinventing myself at that point. I started doing for about 10 years, I was an English as a second language teacher, and that kind of grew into acting, being an academic writing coach.
I could use your help. And,
I'm pretty good at it. She just started a master's program.
I did a lot of masters. I helped a lot of people with their masters.
If you'd like to teach me how to use the APA format, that'd be cool.
That was my least favorite part. I said to the student, I think you need to figure that part out and you can do that and I'll help you with your writing and your grammar and your thought organization and all that stuff. But anyway, I did that. And then in 2014, however many years ago that is, we moved here to Kelowna. So my husband could lead a small little church here for a while. And then I started seriously writing and started writing the books that I knew that I had been carrying around inside me for a long time and wanted to get out into the world. So that's where I'm at now. I'm a newly published author and I actually have, 3 more memoirs, 2 of them fully written and 1 more half written that I have planned with my publisher to publish in the next couple of years.
That's so exciting.
Yeah. Three more.
Yeah.
Memoirs. I knew there was one more.
Three more memoirs.
You mentioned that towards the end of the book that you had another one coming out. I didn't realize there were three more. Yeah.
Wow. That's exciting.
There's three more. Yeah.
Well, you know, I wanted you to share a little bit about that because I wanted to give some perspective on, you know, I knew you as Henry's wife and a women's ministry
such
leader.
Such a bummer for women everywhere to just be known as someone's wife.
Henry's kind of high profile. And, and of course I knew, you know, I knew you in that role and I knew you as a women's ministry leader here in Indianapolis. And I did not know the Marilyn from this memoir. So, this was a completely different perspective on you. So I appreciate you.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of my friends are saying the same thing. They're like, why didn't we know this about you? I think the best answer I can give to that is that I am insatiably curious about other people and I'm always asking questions and I love to hear people's stories. And I think because of that, I just go around collecting people's stories and asking questions. And unless somebody really prompts me and keeps asking follow-up questions, I don't tend to just go off and talk about my own stories.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think that's part of the reason.
Obviously, you know, as someone who's read it, the book is very personal and very revealing. Mm-hmm. And were you concerned about reactions you might receive?
Well, should we maybe talk about a general overview on what part of a memoir this is about? Because that's what I'd like to know, kind of.
Yeah, maybe you should tell us. Yeah, well, describe it for Angela and the rest of the listeners.
I'm not looking. I haven't read it yet, so I'm curious.
Oh, okay. Okay, yeah. So basically, the memoir starts from about age six, and it covers my journey till age 24. And it's a story. I had a very challenging, difficult relationship with my mother, which led to me running away from home at 14 and led to me being in a girl's home with Catholic nuns for a couple of years and then being out on my own, living independently at 16 without a high school diploma. And in all of this, this is in this early 70s. And so I'm a hippie and hanging out with older people that are hippies. And the heart of the story is really a relationship that I was basically, the story is kind of my search for love and belonging. And the heart of the story is a relationship I had with a man named Jack, who was everything that I, more than I ever dreamed of finding in a relationship. And he and I set off on this bicycle journey to South America, but unfortunately he died before we reached South America. And so the last part of that journey in my book is about what I did after his death when I had no plan B for my life. And so I got on my bike and just started riding on my own odyssey. And that's a lot of what the book covers, is that journey for answers and for longing and for love that would not abandon me or leave me or die. Mm-hmm. So that's basically the book in a nutshell.
Yeah, well, I can see where then the question of your follow-up question then, Dad, about it being revealing and
personal.
And personal, sounds very, like, you'd have to be pretty vulnerable to write something like that. So,
I haven't really, I didn't really think too much about that as I wrote it. I was concerned, of course, when you're writing about family and writing about difficult family relationships, it's hard to know what to do with that as a memoir writer because you don't want to make your family look bad or whatever. But so that was a bit of an issue for me with just writing about my mom. But she developed Alzheimer's and then she passed away. So that was kind of, that problem was solved.
Yeah. Kind of opened the door for you to be a little bit more forthcoming.
Yeah.
But as far as the rest of the story, I'm not ashamed of it. I mean, it's a journey. It's different, you know, not the same journey everybody takes, but I think we all have the story of stumbling around, searching for answers before we come to the right stuff. And I wanted to share it. So, my second memoir is going to be much more, revealing, I think.
Oh, really?
Oh, interesting. Okay. Right,
yeah. When is that one coming out? You have any idea?
January.
In January. Okay, so quick.
Schedule for January, yeah.
All right, cool. Very soon. Well, I was just thinking there were a few different things I was kind of intrigued by and a little bit amazed by. You know, the fact that you ran away with your best friend at age 14 and spent actually a few months on your own. Was it in Vancouver? Is that where you were?
In Vancouver, yeah. Yeah.
And you were just on basically...
It wasn't really a few months. It was maybe a month in Vancouver before we were apprehended. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, and then we ran away a second time. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe 5-6 weeks. I don't know.
Well, I find that amazing. I mean, two 14-year-old girls, you know, in what was it, 1970 or something like that, on your own on the streets of Vancouver for weeks.
That's so brave, honestly. Like I think about that my age and me trying to run away from you when we got into that fight, Dad, and I just made it a little bit down the street and I turned back around.
So. Yeah, she's referring to a chapter in my Loving Out Loud book where I yelled at her about the Dr. Peppers and she ran out the door.
Sprite. But anyway,
that's my memory.
Splitting hair. But yeah, no, I would have been way too afraid to do something, you know, like that.
Well, I'd say we were desperate. And we knew that if we didn't get far enough, if we didn't get far enough away from the city where we were from, that we'd probably get caught. So we ran almost 1,000 miles away.
Oh my goodness.
Vancouver from where I was grew up. So yeah. I don't know. Once we got there, it was a whole street culture and there were lots of free social services available and stuff like that. So it wasn't really difficult, surprisingly.
Well, then the second
it's
time.
Funny because I keep hearing.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
The second time we stayed in the city, we decided to stay in the city, and we figured we reasoned that the only way they could really arrest us or get us for anything would be truancy. So as long as we went to school, we'd be good on that count. So we ran away, and you have to read the book to find out where we stayed. But
that's pretty clever.
but kept going to school.
It was like hiding in plain sight, sort of.
Yeah.
Which I thought that was very intriguing.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Oh. And then you know, and then you start this bike journey. I guess I'm jumping around in the storyline because the other thing I was intrigued by was, when you were on your solo bike ride, the very first time you went off after Jack passed away.
And how old were you at that time? At that point.
By then I was 22.
Okay.
And you were riding through the basically from, you know, Canada where you were living, you know, down into Montana and Idaho, and through all those mountains and various hills and hollers, and you were all on your own. Of course, scared to death of bears. I noticed that. and you had the one occasion where the zippers were being zipped while you were in your tent. Asleep, and that was kind of freaking me out for a second. Of course,
terrifying at the moment. Yeah,
I knew you survived, but I didn't know how.
Yeah,
very, very.
Yeah, that was a terrifying moment. Yeah.
The intriguing thing for me was between the time that you ran away and you were in Vancouver on your own, just you and your friend, and you described some of the folks that you were around and you were with, and some of the things that you were doing, and I'll let you share as much as you want to about that. And then you come back home and then you do the second runaway and then you're on your own from that point. And then you end up on this solo journey. It seems to me like you had a lot of dangers circling around you as a very young woman. And somehow you seem to avoided a lot of those somehow.
Well, it's funny because so much of the feedback I've been getting so far from the book is like, oh, you're so brave. I didn't think of myself as being brave or being surrounded by danger at all. I was just kind of doing what I felt compelled to do. I've always kind of had this, I'm pretty optimistic and I've always had this basic trust in people, maybe more than I should, but I've never walked around feeling like there's dangerous predators all around me. I know they're out there, but I don't think about them. So again, like I, when I wrote my list of fears, I share in the book before I set off on myself, you know, that I was afraid of things like bears were definitely a fear, but one that I was going to try to overcome. But most of my fears had to do with just kind of coping alone, coping with loneliness, or I was terrified of my bike breaking down and not knowing how to fix it because I was clueless about mechanics. So, but yeah, I find it, yeah, I maybe as a parent and I'm writing it, I can see more of the dangers that were around me. But at the time, I didn't perceive that. I was just kind of doing what I needed to do to survive.
Yeah, you know, I can totally see how that would be too, because I think when you look around the world expecting to find danger and expecting to find bad things, you will find them. But when you have sort of that mindset of like, I'm just doing what I'm meant to be doing. I'm just, it's like, it's harder to see those. Yeah. I've done some solo travel, obviously nothing to the extent of what you've experienced, but, and I look back on it now and I'm like, oh my gosh, like I was doing this all alone. Like I, anything could have happened to me. But when I was in the situation, but I was
thinking that at the time, right?
Having a beer with a random person that I met here and we're going to go on a road trip together. And, you know, it was, it's interesting how that works out sometimes when you're in sync with.
And I did, you know, like the book does, the theme of faith is quite strong in it. I definitely wasn't a Christian at that point in my life, but I did always kind of have this sense that I was being watched over and protected by God. So, I think that was a huge source of
kind of comfort.
Just feeling like someone was watching out for me. So,
well, I think that's pretty evident. It's pretty evident. So, another thing I was kind of intrigued by was, you know, your lifestyle as, you know, before that fateful last trip, when you ended up kind of finding God, which I won't go into, I'll let you share about it as much as you want to, but if prior to that, I mean, your lifestyle was the hippie lifestyle, right? So it was, you were doing a lot of stuff, that you were using certain things to try to help yourself cope. And you can go into whatever detail you want to there, but you're doing all that. And at the same time, you're quite an accomplished cyclist. I mean, I'm like, I don't do any of that stuff. And I have a hard time keeping my stamina up to go 10 or 15 miles. And, and you're riding 70, 80 miles a day, in the early 70s on old equipment bikes.
An old clunker 10 speed.
It's like, and you don't even have, I mean, you say your one cycling thing was shoes and cycling shoes. And I'm like, how did you do that?
Well, yeah, I was in pretty good shape. I think people, I don't know. I think sometimes people have a perception if you're using drugs, you're all messed up and, you know, it's going to affect if you're going to be addicted and whatever. I was never addicted to anything. I do write about taking some LSD trips and stuff, but that doesn't really mess you up physically. I wasn't doing it all the time. And I was smoking a lot of pot, but that doesn't really mess you up physically either, to my knowledge. Unless you're strung out doing it constantly, but the ironic thing though is that I smoke cigarettes. I started smoking when I was 14 and quit when I was 24. And I was never a heavy smoker, but even while I was doing these bike trips, I would have one cigarette every evening. I carried a pack around. I had one cigarette a night and just couldn't kind of give up that last one. But I remember meeting some cyclists that kind of raised their eyebrows at that. But
like, what are you doing?
What are you doing smoking?
It's funny. Nancy and I went out a couple of weeks ago. There's a little local microbrewery place here on the south side of Indianapolis now called Garfield Park Brewery. And we were sitting outside there having a little kind of what was a pistachio beer, which is a little weird, but
you're looking at me like, I know I wasn't there. I wasn't included in this outing
because you're across the table from me and your mom's behind you. But we had a pistachio beer and we were sitting here drinking it. And some guy rode by on his bicycle, really fast and had a big old cigarette hanging out of his mouth.
I just feel like it comes from your background though, that like smoking is such a a sensitive topic for you, Dad, since you came from such a heavy smoking household.
It is a sensitive topic for me, but still, to me, it just seems counterintuitive to someone who's riding a bike.
I don't think smoking's a healthy habit, but I think that you can do activities and still be someone who smokes from time to time.
Well, that's obvious.
A lot of dancers are heavy smokers, right? I don't know if anymore, probably not, but I know that used to be in the ballet world. A lot of ballet dancers were heavy smokers, and they did it a lot for, you know, as a way of weight control rather than eating, they'd smoke.
Well, lots of
certainly athletic.
Lots of really famous athletes for decades, all the famous athletes, they all smoked. You know, it was just part of life. Second nature to life. Yeah. Probably wasn't until late 80s where that started tailing off. But So the story is really about your difficult, you know, beginning, and then Jack that came along and was really, just a huge part of your heart, and tragically you lose him. And then you've got this grief bubble riding around you. So was it hard writing about that?
Yeah, like all these reliving years later? Some of those memories.
It probably would have been if I'd done it years earlier, but I had to actually. So my second book, my second memoir, is all about dealing with that grief, which I ended up kind of just burying it and suppressing it and thinking it was gone. And then it would pop up here and there, but I would just ignore it. And then 20 years down the road, which is it happened to actually when I was in Indianapolis, that in that time, it just resurfaced and totally flooded my life and almost destroyed me. And that's what that second book is about. So revisiting that period was harder to write about because that was when the grief was really raw and relentless. But writing about the time with Jack and the time that I spent writing by myself was actually, I find it very enjoyable kind of revisiting and thinking more deeply about those times. And I didn't have any notes or journals or diaries or anything. So I found old maps online and tried to retrace the route. So I had a good memory for place names. So I was able to remember a lot through that. It was actually really enjoyable to kind of take that trip down memory lane and write about it again bring it to life again.
Well, I won't go into
not painful.
I won't go into the second details book, and spoil the end of the book, but I did enjoy your story of Henry towards the end, and knowing Henry, and that was especially interesting for me. You tell the story. You know, I think you had Blair and Jack and Paul and Pravesh. And then that crazy evangelical guy in the mountains.
Scott.
Yeah.
And Ron and a few others. Yeah. There was kind of a string of them.
Well, what was it about Henry that locked your heart with his after all those other guys? What snared him? What snared him in your heart?
A weird way of saying that.
Snared him.
I don't know, maybe he snared you.
When we first met, I just really admired him. I really was so impressed with his faith and his authenticity and the way he loved God and the way he loved people. And that's what drew me to him. And it was really just a friendship. He's 3 years younger than I am. I just viewed him as a younger brother. Never in a million years would I be attracted to him, kind of thing. And then that kind of changed, but it was really just his heart for God and the way that translated into, the way he loved people and was just serving and gentle and genuine and,
well, I think that based on your description of some of the other people, it was maybe his genuineness must have really stood out to you at that time. Mm-hmm. I loved your your description of him. You know, when you first met him and how he was dressed and all that. And I'm thinking that's how he dressed in Indy.
So. Yeah, it kind of looks the same now. Yeah, I haven't been able to really make permanent changes on that, but I've tried.
So what was your motivation for writing this?
You say you had these stories for a long time. Like, what finally was it that made you actually put pen to paper?
Yeah.
Well, I knew I was always going to write it. I was kind of like just waiting for the time in my life. I never had time. Being in the ministry was just incredibly, incredibly time demanding. And I never had personal time for anything, really. Like quiet time in the morning, and that was it. And then it was just off to the races 7 days a week, every day. And so there wasn't time to sit down and write, although I knew that I was a writer at heart. Just there was no space for it. So I guess just having finally coming to a time in my life where I had the time, and I was, I started blogging, and I was working with a lot of students on writing, and I was doing the academic writing coaching and editing, and I don't know, it just all kind of came together. But I really just felt it was a story that needed to be shared, that it was different, that it was powerful, that it, you know, that there was value in sharing it, I guess. So, yeah. So I hope maybe that answers your question. I don't know.
Yeah, no, that definitely does. Yeah. I think it's hard too. Yeah. I mean, yeah. There's so many things that I want to do creatively that I just don't, I mean, I don't know when I'll have a chance to do them. Yeah. Dad, you've come up with a really good pattern. I think in the morning is when you write before work, you'll write a bit. I can never seem to fit in time to do any drawing or, you know, writing for fun. It always ends up being, especially now that I'm in grad school, it's like, you know, I've got my 9-to-5 job and then I have to read a bunch of articles. Yeah,
that's a pretty full platter right there. Absolutely. Yeah, no, I admire. I come across tons of writers that do it the way Mike's doing it. They get up before work, and even, you know, mothers with kids and jobs that still get up in the morning and write. I think I applaud them. But I didn't. You know, we just didn't have that room in our schedule in the ministry model that we were part of. It's like you got up early, but you were your first time in the morning was your quiet time, and then the rest of the day was filled with appointments and people and a lot, you know, into the evening. And, I look back on that now and I think I don't, like you, Mike, you were kind of marveling at the stamina I had for bike riding. I look back and I think, how do we keep that schedule? Like, I just couldn't do it anymore.
That's
funny. And I was never in the full-time ministry in our brotherhood organization. And yet I was so busy at the time. I couldn't think how to do certain things and how to accomplish them. So I can imagine how much multiplied that was for you in your role. And, you know, and just for the listeners who aren't familiar with Marilyn and what, you know, our backgrounds are as far as church goes, the organization we're in had the women basically working side by side with their husbands in full-time ministry. As hard, they didn't do all the public stuff, maybe, but they did all the other stuff. Is that a fair statement? You did almost everything Henry did. Is that pretty much
everything? Right? Plus keep the household running, and you know, parent, that, you know, be a good mom, be a great wife, be a great friend, and you know, we were part of an organization that expected a lot from all our members. So if you're in the full time ministry, it's like, well, the members that aren't in the ministry, they're working full time, and then they're coming home every evening, and they're giving their time and life and their weekends to ministry activities as well. So, how can I take personal time? Like, so I'd be, you know, working all day in the ministry, working all evening in the ministry, and then I felt like I didn't feel like I was entitled to any time to myself.
Right.
So I didn't take it.
Even just hearing about it just makes me tired. It's so exhausted.
It was exhausting. Yeah.
Especially now. Yeah. Like, I mean, I feel like there's so much pressure. No, not pressure. I feel like there's a lot of societal shift on how it's important to make sure that, you know, there's sort of a work-life balance. And that's, I mean, what you're doing is important work, you know, but it is a lot. And how do you keep that up? It's, you know, I don't even know.
Yeah.
Well, now your early life is so incredibly different from your later life. Do you think that hindered or helped you in your ministry life later on? All your history and background, Was it helpful to
you? I think it helped me tremendously. I think because of some of the hardships that I went through and situations I was in, I think it helped me develop a lot of empathy for people. And I think I was exposed to a lot of different people and situations and lifestyles. And I think all that really helped in the ministry to just be able to relate to different kinds of people. I've always kind of seen that as one of my strengths. And I think it did come from that kind of colorful background that I had. I can walk up to anybody and start talking about anything kind of thing. And I think a lot of that started with the the solo traveling and being on my own early and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
What do you hope this book will do for people as they read it?
Yeah. Like, do you want them to take away?
Yeah. I mean, we know that, this was a really great tool to help you, to cope and deal and get all this out. But what do you hope your readers take away from it?
Well, I think different readers will take away different things from it. And I'm already getting all kinds of different sort of responses to that question. But as I was writing it, it was really gratifying for me to see how the events of my life kind of streamed together, and I could see God's hand in all of it. And I could see how he was, the people that he allowed me to meet or interact or get together with or leave or whatever, that all was part of forming who I became, who I am now. And I hope people can sort of see that in their own life. It'll make them think more about maybe, not see their life as so much as random events, but to see a storyline and a narrative there that will help them make sense of things and help them be at peace with some of the difficult things in their life too, because you can start seeing your life all as a God ordained or God, I don't want to say driven, but
directed maybe.
You can start seeing that. Yeah, if you can start seeing your life that every part of it, God was watching over you and guiding you and bringing you to where you are now, it really helps to make peace with those difficult parts of our past and not feel, not feel bitterness or shame or regret, but just feel gratitude. So that's really what I hope people get from it. Yeah.
Now you got three more memoirs coming. So can you tell us about those three different?
Okay. So the second one is called The Box Must Be Empty. And that one actually begins around the time that we were in Indianapolis and the grief resurfaced, and it covers about, maybe 15 more years working through a lot of grief and trauma. And that one I really hope will help tons of people to process and work through their own grief and trauma, because everybody's carrying stuff around. And I think a lot of times we're kind of unaware of how much we're carrying until it starts to swamp our lives. So that's the second book. And the third book is a little lighter. It's about a couple of years that we spent in Bombay as part of the mission team to Bombay, that whole adventure in India. And then the third one is about our time in Africa. I mean, the fourth one, about our time in Africa. We spent about 3.5 years in Lagos and a couple of years in South Africa, and it's all about those adventures. And yeah.
Well, I think you need to write another one detailing your wins.
Yeah.
You're winning the Mission Challenge ride.
It's going to be a very short book.
Oh, that one. Yeah.
When I ignorantly made it a race.
For some context, for those of you who aren't aware of their inside laughter here, there was a while back in the early, 1999-ish, early 2000s. No,
the first one was 96. The last one was 2002.
Late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah.
They put on an annual summer bike ride to kind of raise money for a nonprofit that the organization supported. And it was a 70 or so mile bike ride.
Roughly 70, 75.
So you guys kind of had some camaraderie with that.
Yeah. Well, I was excited.
Yeah.
I was excited.
I think the first year I won in the women's division, and the second year I got hopelessly lost. I got off the track somehow.
Uh-oh.
And lost a lot of time wandering on the wrong road to try to find my way back. So the second one, I
and that was the last time we saw her.
Yeah.
And that, yeah, I never saw me.
We're still looking
for
you.
That's when I disappeared.
I don't think I ever heard that story, Marilyn. Maybe that's something offline you can tell me about sometime. But
Yeah.
It was great having you join us on the ride. And the cool thing was Henry riding it, because he was never the cyclist, mm-hmm. right? You were the cyclist, so.
Totally. Yeah.
I remember him laying on top of a picnic table after he was done. And I was a little worried about him actually, but he did fine.
He made it through.
I think that was probably his last long bike ride ever.
Maybe his first
understandable.
And last.
So,
first and last. Yeah. I think maybe that was. Yeah.
So where can folks find your books or this book and then your future books? Where can they find your book right now?
Well, I've got a website, which is marilyncrete.com. So you can go there. They can go directly to Amazon and order from Amazon. If you go to my website, there's more different buying options besides Amazon that are on there. There's a universal buy button there, so you can choose different options. So that's where to get it. So they can just Google my name. My site should come up right away.
Is that something we could link to in the show notes when we
episode? I can probably put that in the show notes.
That way people have immediate access to that.
MarilynCrete.com.
That'd be great. That's it.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, now, have you listened to any of our previous episodes? I'll put you on the spot.
I haven't. Probably not. I want to, yeah.
You haven't yet. Okay,
no, don't do it.
You don't know what's coming then. We always end an interview with something called the random question.
All right. I've got some more complaints to raise here.
Angela has a complaint.
I wanted to say, if you've listened to any of our previous episodes, you know that I'm always giving my dad here a hard time about having like maybe 10 to 15.
We had eight in there.
Eight? We had eight random questions in this piece of Tupperware that he makes guests pick questions out of. So I always get mad. I'm like, you don't have enough questions. Like, you got to keep putting new questions in there. Or you're going to hear the same answers all the time. Yeah. So I went out of my way for his birthday to buy a game that has like hundreds of random questions in it. And he forgot about it. Like, he didn't even remember that I got it for him. Mind you, his birthday wasn't that long ago. And so I pulled.
Well, he's getting on in years, Angela. He's getting on in years.
I'm going to remind him that you said that. I'm going to say that every time.
Thank you, Marilyn. thank you. I think. I completely forgot that she got me that game, and I'm going to have to go through that and look at it in more detail.
It's really convenient that we have this podcast so that I can shame you in public and not just,
privately. Well, it's public record now.
Yeah. Now everybody knows.
Yeah. And then our biggest fan, Jim Babb, will give you a hard time for picking on your dad.
I actually think that Jim Babb would support me making fun of you.
Well, we'll find out, cause I'm sure he'll tell us.
Yes.
So, we need to pull a random question out, and this could be on almost anything, Marilyn.
I've got the Tupperware here. You said there's new questions in there, though?
New questions, but the old ones are still in there.
You went to the effort to putting new questions in this question box, and you completely forgot we had hundreds of new questions.
I completely forgot, yes. Here is a new one.
This one is, where was your here we go. First question, where was your very first date?
Where was my first date?
Yeah.
Yeah, your very first one that you would consider a date.
Yeah, it can be whatever you imagine it to be.
It's an interesting question because in all those years I had boyfriends and relationships and so on, which you can read all about in my book. We didn't really date because we were hippies, right? So we didn't really go on dates. Mm-hmm. So probably the first real date would be with Henry, and he took me to see the Nutcracker Ballet.
Oh, that's fancy.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a good date.
Cool. And he got his hair cut for the occasion, and he got a new pair of shoes.
It's funny because my first thought is, he had a crush on you. And I'm like, well, of course he did.
He had a big time crush on me. Yeah.
Oh, that is so cute. I love that.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
My first date was to the Prairie Creek Reservoir in Muncie, Indiana for the 4th of July fireworks. And I was 16 years old. The girl who would soon become my girlfriend was 17, and we were in the same youth group. And
cool.
I didn't get my first kiss there. That came a a couple of weeks later.
You're asking too much. First date and first kiss? Like, there's no way. No, you can't get that lucky.
I didn't ask that one. But, yeah, I was nervous. It was my first date. And, you know, her dad was, I went to pick her up and her dad was like, you know, have her back by, you know.
Kind of scary.
Like, well, Mr. Whatever, I won't share his name, but Mr. I'll bring her back as soon as the fireworks are over. We'll come straight home. And we did. I don't remember if I said it exactly like that. Probably
something. You were kind of scared.
I was nervous. I was always scared of him. Scared of Bud. I was scared of Bud. Bud was his first name.
Yeah. Well, that's what my first date was with Kyle. We'll just leave it with Kyle. And you did not like him.
I did not care for Kyle.
But he took me to Longhorn Steakhouse. I think that was the first date. And I just remember feeling like, oh my gosh, because I was a sophomore and he was a senior. And I was like, oh my goodness, this cute boy likes me. And he asked me to go to homecoming with him on our first date. And then not long after, he dumped me for a freshman in the color guard.
See,
so it was a bummer.
I was right for not liking him.
Well, yeah, but he also, I don't know, Dad, he was handsome and older. What can I say?
He called me dude. You know, Angela, Marilyn.
Yeah, that's
not good. Marilyn, Angela told me she had to go somewhere. She said, Kyle's going to call and he's going to ask for my cell phone number. Can you make sure that you give him my cell phone number when he calls? I'm like, okay. Well, so he calls and I said, hello, you know, obviously. And he goes, hello. This is Kyle. Can I have Angela's cell phone number? And I said, sure. And I gave it to him. He goes, thanks, dude.
He was probably nervous.
You don't call a girl's dad. He was probably nervous.
I mean, he wasn't. He ended up being a somewhat unsavory character in the story of my life. But you know, I don't think you should get too hung up on dude comment. You know,
hey, it's my dad. I'm your dad. It's my job to get hung up on those things. Well, Marilyn, thanks for answering the question. I certainly appreciate that. The Nutcracker in Toronto.
That would have been so nice.
Pretty awesome. Angela, actually, Marilyn, probably about 3 years ago. When was your friend's wedding up in Canada?
Angela? They got married. Oh my gosh, it'll probably be 3 years this fall.
Okay, so 3 years ago this fall, Nancy and I attended Angela's best friend's wedding up near Toronto.
They moved to Ottawa now, though. And I'm going to visit them hopefully once we're allowed to go to Canada again.
We spent a few nights, two or three nights in Toronto. So we got to kind of tour around Toronto a little bit, which was fun.
Yeah.
But that's probably pretty far away from where Marilyn currently
Very
lives.
Far away.
From where she is now. Probably. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a pretty big difference. Yeah.
Probably about as far as Detroit to
that's like
Yakima, Washington.
When I was in Australia and the little school kids would be like, oh yeah, miss, you're from Indiana. Like, where's that? I've been to California. Like, you know, what is that near California?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was my really terrible. It almost sounded Kiwi. I'm never going to do that again. Sorry, everyone.
Yeah. See, I'm not the only one that embarrasses themselves on public.
I'm
airways.
Not embarrassed. I'm just, ashamed. I would say ashamed at my sorry Australian accent. It's way out of practice.
That was pretty bad because you used to actually have a pretty good.
I spent a lot of time in Australia trying to perfect it. So,
yeah. Well, Marilyn, I appreciate you taking time out on this afternoon to talk with us. I'm excited about your book. I hope that it does really, really well for you. And I'm now excited to get your
sequel.
Thank
you so much.
Definitely tell Henry hello for me. And
well, he also sends his regards to you and make sure you say hi to Mike. So
I can't believe it's been over 20 years. I was thinking that you were here into the early 2000s, like, you know, 2001,
no,
or
I think
2002.
Yeah, I think I left in 2000. Yeah.
Wow.
We were there we were in Indianapolis when for Y2K.
Okay.
And then right after that we left unexpectedly.
Okay.
But you can read all about that in my second book.
Yeah, I'll look forward to reading that.
A little teaser there. Yeah. Get excited for it.
Mm-hmm. So, well, I will let you go. Again, thank you very much. And we'll sign
to up. Everyone. Please remember to rate and review us if you ever get the chance, or if you care about us at all, if you would prefer for us to keep doing this, that'd be great. And also a special thanks to Bill Whitehair, who is the best person on the entire planet, deserves all the compliments for editing, doing a lot of editing work and producing this podcast.
Yeah. Bill takes my rough edits and refines them and then posts them. And
Bill is an actual professional in the industry, so he knows what he's doing.
The rest of us are amateurs. So thank you, Bill. Thank you, listeners.
Thank you, Marilyn.
Yes, and thank you, Marilyn. So with that, we will sign off, and we will catch you next time on the Cutter's Notch podcast.
The Cutter's Notch podcast is available through most podcast listing providers. New episodes drop approximately twice a month. You can email Michael at authormichaeldecamp@gmail.com. Michael DeCamp is the author of two novels, Abandoned Hope, Cutter's Notch Book 1, and Nozomi's Battle, Cutter's Notch Book 2, a collection of short stories entitled Cutter's Notch Interludes, and one nonfiction Christian devotional book entitled Loving Out Loud, Learning to Love in a Hate-Filled World. All books can be found on Amazon or ordered from your local bookseller. Please join us again on the next episode of the Cutter's Notch podcast.